We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is Keith Weiner. Keith is the president of the Gold Standard Institute and the CEO of Monetary Metals. How are you today, Keith?
Doing good, Tom. Good to see you again.
Absolutely. Great to have you back. So you recently released the Gold Outlook Report for 2022. And in it, you say that there's no shortage of people out there that are making price predictions. So what's hard to find and even harder to do is to be consistently accurate. So what goes into making the forecast accurate? And how do you think about what to take into account to make that forecast?
So it's a really interesting question. I guess the first thing is, it's kind of like that sculptor when somebody asked him, you know, how do you carve an elephant? And he said, okay, you start out with a block of stone and remove everything that isn't an elephant. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, that's either, you know, BS or that's really profound, depending on what level the guy is. Apparently he was a good sculptor. We start out and we have some discussion in the Outlook report of a lot of things not to try to take into account, either because they're just simply not really true or not right as the populist theory would hold. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking about, you know, various allegations of manipulation and paper shorting and all that, which I've written tons about and published tons of data on. Or there are things that are true. Like if you get the data about how many tons were imported into India or exported or whatever, those things are true, but not terribly useful. How many tons flow into an ETF, or what I call the famous buyer fallacy. Mm-hmm. So I think not too long before writing that report, Ireland announced that, you know, the Irish Central Bank had bought a certain number of tons of gold, which is true. I mean, I assume it's true anyway. But, you know, how useful is that? And so, you know, gold being a monetary metal that's been mined and accumulated for 5,000 years, there's lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of it heaped up in piles and treasure hoards all around the world. And the movement of gold from one of those piles to another isn't predictive of price. It just isn't. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, you have the famous, what I call the famous buyer fallacy, that Ireland being famous, oh, they bought it, that means the gold's going to go up. Well, okay, but then there's 10,000 people who sold it to them. Are they not equally likely to be right that 10,000 people thought it was going to go down? Is there not wisdom in crowds? Is there not, you know, crowdsourcing? You know, people try to build algorithms to mine Twitter and whatever. And I think the answer is there's no real data there. Gold is bought and sold all the time. Gold is moved all the time. Sometimes the buyers are famous. Sometimes the sellers are famous. Mm-hmm. Sometimes not. And none of that really gives you any information content to try to predict the price. So what we do in our forecasting for the short term, we look at the gold basis and the silver basis. Mm-hmm. Every time somebody says, oh, there's a shortage of 1,000-ounce bars, my silver fund can't source silver, we look at the silver basis, which tells us whether, you know, whether that's likely to be true or not, whether somebody's just talking their book or whatever.
Maybe before we move on, just give us a quick explanation of what the basis is again, please.
So a really short definition, the basis is the future price minus the spot price. So normally the future price should be a bit higher, and that reflects the cost of storage and the interest expense to finance it. So if you want to buy silver but not take delivery today, you want somebody to hold it for you and deliver it in a month or 6 months or 12 months or whatever, you're going to pay a little bit for that service. And that's closely related to the cost of interest and plus the cost of storage. If the basis is a positive number and rising, what that means is there's a profit for somebody to buy physical silver and simultaneously sell a futures contract, which is called carry, or carrying silver. Mm-hmm. They don't own it, but they've just locked in a spread. So if you can buy spot silver at 24 and sell, I don't know, a July contract at 24.50, you know, you just made 50 cents. And then, you know, you can annualize that, calculate that as an interest rate and say, okay, that's a better investment than, you know, buying a treasury or whatever of that same duration. So we look at the basis, which is this measure. And when it inverts, when it spot is higher than future, then that means there's a shortage. And especially if that spread is moving in that direction, that a spot is getting higher and higher relative to futures, then that means there's a real scarcity, there's a real shortage. So we perform some calculations based on this. We calculate something that we call the fundamental price that asks, tries to answer the question, what would the price be if it was set purely in the physical metal market and the speculators who can use leverage, right? So when you go to the futures market, you can get 10 to 1 leverage. If we backed out the effects of the speculators, so sometimes the speculators are pessimistic and they're shorting the market. Sometimes the speculators are optimistic, they're bullish, and they're going long the market, and they're using leverage so they can move the price around at the margin, you know, quite a bit, disproportionately to the amount of capital they put up. What if we backed out the actions of the speculators? Where would the price be? That's what our fundamental price is trying to answer. And so we come up with a number and we plot graphs of this and so on. That's for the short term. That's saying, okay, this rumor is not true. You know, silver is not in scarcity right now. Maybe it's a retail scarcity of 1 ounce minted products or even small bars, but not in the commercial silver market. But for longer term, we try to look at the same thing that everyone else does, which is the macroeconomics, but with a different slant, a lot less focus on consumer prices. I've written tons and tons and tons about why consumer prices aren't necessarily a reflection of monetary forces. And this year, if I can just sort of delve into this for a minute, I said that this is the hardest year. We've been doing this for, I think this is our 10th year. And then I was doing this for a private newsletter for a couple of years prior to that. And this was the hardest, I think, by far, to try to make a call, because we stand at this fork in the road. And that is the Fed really going to go through? I mean, they threatened to do something that I think is, going to be self-harm, to cut off their nose despite our face. And that is hike interest rates. Mm-hmm. Are they really going to go through with that? And if they do, then there's an awful lot of assets that are going to crash awfully hard. And, in that sell-off, I mean, everything's going to get caught up. And I argue that gold less so, as it was less in 2008. Gold sold off less than everything else. And gold was the first to move on to a new all-time high, which it did by January of 2009. Everything else was years and years before it, made new highs. Silver will sell harder than gold. And I think this time around, gold will sell less than it did, because by 2008, gold had been in this bull market with not really that much volatility for a number of years. So it was a pretty safe trade to put leverage on. And then that leverage had to be unwound. This time around, I just don't think there's that kind of leverage in gold, because it just is a volatile trade and leverage is going to wash people out of their positions. On the other hand, if the Fed were to back away and whine and put their tail between their legs and cringe and come back to, look for a scratch behind the ears or whatever the analogy would be, and it's okay, all that, like a bad Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, all that stuff we said about, hiking rates. Remember, in several movies, he used to say, "I lied." If they come back and say that, and, all this tightening is off, hiking is off, we're going to do more easing, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and, interest rates are going to stay at zero basically forever, then I think you're going to see a huge rally in every kind of asset, but gold likely more so than, say, stocks. And so, trying to predict where the price is going to be in a year implies trying to predict what the Fed is going to do. And that's fundamentally not my approach, and certainly not what any of our data is doing. Mm-hmm. It's hard to tell what somebody's going to do when they're under pressure, political pressure, economic pressure, all their constituents, the banks are calling them, everybody's calling them constantly all day. And how are they going to respond to that? I have no idea. I don't think anybody else does either. So they're going to have to pick one side of this fork or the other. And depending on which way they go, we're going to get a very different price action.
So, Keith, when we think about, let's say, the accuracy of the reports in the past, I would say the worst year, you kind of go over the accuracy in the report. So the worst year, as you self-published, was last year. So is that part of the conundrum that's carrying into this year, is the behavior of some of these market forces that are really affecting gold?
Yeah, I mean, I think everything we said last year is still true. And so those forces are just building. Mm-hmm. And that is the quality. I mean, the dollar is a credit instrument, and we call it money, and people get confused and try to deduce from definitions and make all these mistakes. But the dollar is a credit instrument, and a credit instrument's not worth anything more than your estimation or the market's estimation of the creditworthiness of the borrower. And as the government continues on with its mad fiscal policies, it's a whole different issue than the Fed and its easing, which is monetary policy. But you have madness on both sides of the, of the house. as people begin to think about that, it's logical to say, I'm gonna own some gold. I'm gonna take some chips off the table. This is completely bananas. And even very mainstream, very conventional thinkers, you know, buttoned up finance people and bankers and whatever, that never really had cause to question that the dollar is an irredeemable credit, or never thought in such terms, or if you said it to them, it never really registered. As they look at what the Fed's doing, what the Treasury's doing, you know, and the magnitude of it is growing too, right? I mean, I remember when Bush Jr. was running a $400 billion deficit, and the attitude at the time was, oh my God, I mean, that is such stupendous, astronomical, hyperinflation any day now, you know, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Now we look at $400 billion, my God, that is so quaint, that's so small time. It's like looking at a car commercial from the 1950s, mm-hmm. and you see this family luxury car for, you know, $1,400 or something like that. So even those folks that are not particularly inclined to liberty as a movement, and not particularly inclined to monetary theories or alternative assets or those sorts of things, just have to be looking at this and one by one saying, something's gone deeply, deeply wrong here. And even if I don't know what it is, you know, let me just go buy 5 or 10 ounces of gold and stick it in the wherever sock drawer, under the mattress, wherever it might be. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is latent. But then, you know, kind of interesting, in the couple of weeks subsequent to publishing the Outlook report, which I think we published January 31, so it has been 3 weeks since then, obviously the price of gold moved up a bit. And it's the funniest stealth bull market ever. I mean, you know, if you watch CNBC, they have in the lower right-hand corner, you know, they're cycling through the S&P and the Dow. Sometimes they put the FTSE in there. Sometimes they put Bitcoin in there. And it seems like gold doesn't come up in the rotation nearly as often as it used to. Mm-hmm. And, you know, nobody likes gold at this point. It's unloved, and it's either neglected or hated. And here we are within a hair's breadth of its all-time high price. I mean, what other market would be in that posture, mm-hmm. right? And so I think this just reflects, people are just buying it, and probably not a great deal of speculation either. People are just buying it because, not necessarily they think gold makes sense, but maybe because they think everything else doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. So then they end up with some gold as a antidote or whatever. And I think those forces just continue to build.
So Keith, when we think about, let's say, two of the assets that you just mentioned there, gold and Bitcoin, how do they differ? And do you think that the volatility of each changes the behavior of the market participants in each of them?
So I argue, I've noticed the Bitcoiners are now picking up this argument on their side, but I argue that if one uses I make an analogy to the time of Copernicus, and they had a geocentric view before Copernicus, that everything went around the Earth. And then trying to explain the motion of Jupiter and Venus was very difficult because you had this so-called retrograde motion. It just didn't make any sense. So, I mean, just even describing it mathematically was very complicated, the equations. And then logically, what is causing things to go backwards and forwards like that? And when you realize that the heliocentric model is right, that everything's going around the sun, including the Earth, things just become simpler and easier. So when you have I call it a papero-centric model, that you think everything goes around the dollar and gold is going up and down and Bitcoin, everything's going up and down relative to the dollar, mm-hmm. then there's certain things that just don't make sense. But when you say, as I've done and argued, you know, at length from a number of different theoretical points, gold is actually the center. Gold isn't volatile at all. It's the dollar that's going, you know, up and down and mostly down. And one should measure the dollar in gold. And if one does that, one has a simpler and cleaner picture, the same way that if you think things are going around the sun. Mm-hmm. So it's gold that's the constant. It's the closest thing to the economic constant, a constant of economic value. The Bitcoiners try to argue that for Bitcoin, but of course, Bitcoin is so incredibly volatile. It's just really hard to picture that, you know, since 2009, you know, the price of a Honda has gone from, you know, what, 35,000 Bitcoins to one Bitcoin. That there's been a 35,000 to one collapse, like a hyper deflationary collapse in everything from cars to real estate to businesses. Mm-hmm. It's saying that businesses have destroyed 99.9998% of their value since 2009. When you say that aloud, it just becomes, it's not true. So Bitcoin is a speculative asset, you know, go up, it can go down. I've said many times it could be a dollar, it could be $1 million or anywhere in between, and probably will. I have no insight as to where the price will go next. Neither do the people who told you to buy it at $69,000 last November. They don't have any insight either.
The people that told you to mortgage your house and eat insects to buy more Bitcoin at that price. Worms,
that's right. Yeah. And then they have little laser beams coming out of their eyes, so you know that they're serious. but, you know, I mean, all mockery aside, and that's not really my style. I think that it's not money. I think that it's not sound. I think it's missing some important characteristics, not least of which is tangible physical reality. If you own a gold coin, you have a physical thing, and that represents final payment. When not everybody, and not all the time, but there is a time and a need for taking your marbles home and not playing in the sandbox anymore. And when you take the delivery of the gold coin, that's the final payment. And the Bitcoin, they say, well, you could have a cold wallet on a USB thumb drive, which is true, but the thumb drive isn't the Bitcoin, it's only the clean check. So I use the analogy, and credit to Steve Forbes for the analogy of a coat check closet. You go to a fancy restaurant, you check your coat, and you get a little slip of paper. Well, you could digitize that piece of paper and put that on your USB thumb drive. But that little USB thumb drive is not going to keep you warm when you go out into the Alberta winter. You actually need the coat for that, and not the thumb drive with the clean check number for the coat. And that's one of the key differences of gold versus Bitcoin. So Bitcoin, you know, speculative. I know a lot of people have made a lot of money betting on it. I wouldn't necessarily bet that trend is over. I know there are prominent voices in the gold community who equate price action with, you know, virtue. So, well, gold is the better money because look how it's outperforming Bitcoin. I'm like, I don't agree with that argument. And not to mention, that's kind of a silly one, because certainly up until November, Bitcoin price was outperforming gold price massively. But I don't think that price action really provides any insight into that.
Well, it's kind of interesting. You know, you and I were speaking before we hit record here today about the situation in Canada where people's bank accounts are getting seized. And we had kind of made the parallel to when the Cyprus banking system froze up. And, you know, I kind of made the remark to you that people seem to have a short memory and that history often rhymes, right? So when we see capital controls come in, that is a point at which all of a sudden gold and silver really become valuable again, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tangible good. And this gets into the discussion when people say, well, there's so many ounces of silver out there, so many ounces of gold. And I'm like, people have been mining the stuff for 5,000 years, accumulating the stuff for 5,000 years, and they've been hiding it from their governments and from their nosy neighbors for 5,000 years. Like, you can't inventory it. You can't add it all up. You have no idea how much of that stuff has been accumulated. That's a lot more than the official estimates. Well, part of that is if you needed to escape, I know people who escaped Hungary one step ahead of the, you know, Soviet tanks that were rolling in 1956. And in one particular case, the father of the family, so the guards came with the machine guns to stop them. The father took off a gold watch and handed it to the sergeant of the guard or wherever it was. And the guy looked at it and he could, you know, obviously gold, real gold is real gold, and you could tell. And then he said, get the hell out of here. The border with Austria is 15 minutes that way. My men are going to go patrol over there. And when we come back, you better be gone or you're dead. And they had their chance to leave because that was a gold watch. You know, a piece of paper with, you know, stuff on it wouldn't have, I don't think would have worked.
Or a USB thumb drive.
USB thumb drive. I promise it has Bitcoin keys on it. That's right. No, not so much.
So Keith, is it only all about the Fed and the Fed's actions, or do news events like, for example, the Russia-Ukraine situation right now change your outlook as well?
You know, to me, I'm no expert on that kind of political war situation. You know, I know people on both sides, or I guess there are several sides of that. So I'm not going to really opine on that. I'm not an expert in that. I do think that that sort of adds to the general backdrop of tension and, you know, things aren't good, but often in a counterintuitive way. And that is, you know, when the mob is looking for the flight to safety trade, they're going to buy treasury bonds to such a degree that every gold bug and every inflationist and every libertarian is just going to be stupefied at the amount of buying of treasury bonds, and therefore the collapse in the interest rate, at least to the government. Now, you know, the interest rate to the marginal shale oil explorer could be really high, but interest rate to the government, the 10-year is going to go well below 1% when that happens. But in terms of price of gold, you know, is Ukraine really affecting the price of gold? From what I've read so far, I don't think that's the case. You know, obviously, if things really begin to escalate and looks like, you know, the eve of World War III, it'll be a whole different story. From what I can tell right now, it doesn't look like World War III is coming. Mm-hmm. And in part because I don't think Europe would really be, even if assuming the U.S. wanted it, which I'm not sure the U.S. government does, I don't think the Germans would be on board with that. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, they want the oil and gas to keep flowing. The spice must flow.
So when we look at something, for example, like the rise in M1, does that translate to higher gold prices, Keith?
I don't believe so. And in years past, in our Outlook reports, we've published graphs looking at various measures of quantity of dollars, so-called money supply. And there isn't really a good correlation to the price of gold. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. And ultimately, I argue that the whole quantity theory of money is bunk, that it just doesn't work the way people assume that it does. So some early monetarists, going back to Wicksell in the 1890s, were trying to study the correlation between the quantity of money and prices. And that's what they expected to find. And what Wicksell found was it wasn't that correlation, but there was a correlation between the interest rate and the price level, mm-hmm. which he couldn't explain, but he was an honest enough scientist to write about that and talk about that. That later became, so this is understood, and this later became known as Gibson's paradox. It's the interest rate that kind of drives things. But nobody could really explain it. And I think there's a pretty simple explanation, but a pretty unconventional one. And that is, there's an arbitrage between the interest rate and profit margins. Rising interest rate means widening margins. Falling interest rate means falling margins. And the reason is, as the interest rate falls, every new potential entrant into the market suddenly sees their cost going down. And if the profit is you know, the same, then they'll borrow and go into the market. So it becomes an increasing subsidy to borrow to build capacity to come into the market. And then a rising interest rate is the opposite. Suppose you've been manufacturing widgets, whatever, microphones for 10 years, and your plant is all worn out, and now you want to borrow money to replace the plant. Well, now the interest rate's 18%. You haven't got a business case to do that. You're going to shut down because you can't make any money if you borrow at 18%. Mm-hmm. And so it's the interest rate, not for consumer prices anyways, not the money supply. But then as far as gold goes, gold is not a consumer good. I mean, even if you buy gold for jewelry, it's still really a monetary reservation demand. And when you're done with that jewelry, if it goes out of style, it goes back into the melt. It always does. I mean, it maybe a little bit wears off as you wear the ring, but not much. And the price of gold, again, being an inverse essentially of the price of the dollar measured in gold, that's really an estimation of the imminence of default by the government and maybe opportunity cost. So if I can own treasuries at 2%, well, maybe that's an interesting thing for me to do. If the interest rate falls to 0.5% on that same 10-year treasury as it did in March of 2020, well, there's no opportunity cost anymore to sell the treasury and buy gold. So people do. So, you know, if there's a thing to be looking at, a macro indicator, it would be not real interest rates, but the spread between time preference and the interest rate. And if the interest rate gets below somebody's time preference, then they say, I'm out of here, and they buy gold. Mm-hmm.
So why is the conventional prescription of hiking interest rates to cure inflation wrong? Why is the cause not monetary?
So people think that, you know, inflation is everywhere and always a monetary phenomenon. Milton Friedman said that, and that's the accepted canon. So if you want to decrease the quantity of money, you know, hike the interest rate. And, you know, first of all, you can't really do that. And if you take a look at the graph of M1, it's not the case that you see M1 going down. You know, so you can't unprint the money, as it were, once it's there. Mm-hmm. But leaving that aside, So they think it's quantity thinking. Okay, we have to get the quantity down and that will cause prices to go down. The problem we have today is there are four non-monetary forces, significant ones that are driving prices up. one that I've been writing about for years that I call useless ingredients, which is when the government forces producers to put things in their products that consumers don't value and don't even necessarily know about. So in gasoline, we force them to put ethanol. At least people are aware of that. But every other product, you know, there's all kinds of things that go into it that people don't even know about. And that hikes the price. And then in recent years, I think we have three that are very worth talking about. Green energy restrictions. So, you know, in your neck of the woods, the market for selling, you know, crude was harmed when in the U.S. we politicized the Keystone Pipeline. Right, and that was supposed to bring crude oil from the places where it's produced in Alberta down to where they can refine it. Mm-hmm. And then by stopping that pipeline and other, you know, similar ones that are less famous, you know, then you see the price of oil rising. And then in some places like the UK and Germany, I mean, it's just off the charts what they've done with green restrictions. But now this is an interesting thing because it's not that the price of oil rose. It fell in one place and it rose somewhere else. The price of crude in Alberta went down at the same time that the price of refined products in Houston went up. So what you have is a widening of spreads, which means a lessening of coordination in the economy, not a monetary force. The third thing being what I call COVID lockdown whiplash. First, we shut everything down. All the ships got out of location. We changed buying habits, changed all sorts of things. We busted supply chains all over the place. Then we said, okay, we'll unlock it and let everything go. The unlocking is like the whiplash of a steel cable that has a lot of tension on it. And when it finally lets go, it doesn't just drop to the ground. I mean, the lash can take somebody's head off. Mm-hmm. So we have, to this day, snafus in shipping, logistics, trucking, warehousing, all these industries have just been totally smashed about. And then finally, trade war, which is broader than just tariffs. Although I noticed the U.S., was it November, December, doubled the tariff again on Canadian imported lumber. So once again, you're going to see a lower price of lumber at the sawmill in Canada and a higher price of lumber paid by the American home builder or the American consumer at Home Depot. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of other ways that trade war is hitting everybody. And every major corporation, their supply chain departments must be working overtime trying to figure out what jurisdictions are going to be politically palatable, which jurisdictions are likely to have retaliatory tariffs and all kinds of things. So everything's being shifted around. Don't buy from there anymore. Buy from here. Build something domestically. Don't import it. All of which is causing huge amounts of dislocation, delays, cost increases, just bizarre, you know, things, all of which is causing, you know, prices to skyrocket, but not for monetary reasons. And then if the Fed thinks they can correct it with monetary medicine, you're going to find that not only won't that work, but then it will cause additional problems as well. Mm-hmm.
So Keith, I'd like to go back to something we were kind of touched on earlier. How do real rates affect the gold price?
So it's another one of those things I've plotted a graph. And if you look at a long enough time horizon, you see there isn't really a great correlation there either. Mm-hmm. Now, philosophical, I have a problem with the term real rates, and I've ranted about this. So let me, if I may, use your show and your platform to give my little rant. And it goes something like this. The actual rate that actual lenders actually lend to actual borrowers is now packaged up and put in a box labeled nominal. And then separately from that, we go to consumer prices. And in fourth grade math, I remember, you know, being taught that you can't add apples and oranges. But in the consumer price index, we can add, so an average is adding two things and dividing by two, right? So we add apples and oranges and fuel and rent and all kinds of other things. And we come up with a measure that even the people who believe in this and even the people who do it for a living can't really agree as to what the right, you know, what are the right things to be included in there. And then how do you take into account, I wrote an article saying, take a look at a Honda Accord from 1997 versus 20 years later. I think I wrote it in 2017. You know, the 2017 one has, you know, 17 airbags versus zero airbags in 1997. It was like almost triple the horsepower, you know, electronics packages up the wazoo, leather, this, that, and the other thing, better stopping distance, better handling, better ride quality. How do you account for the increase in price? Surely part of it goes to, we have more stuff in the car. And then some of it is inflation, so-called. So anyways, we end up with some net number that even though nobody really agrees on it, that's the inflation number. And you subtract, take nominal interest rate minus the inflation rate, and then that's the real rate at which nobody is lending and nobody is borrowing. We call that the real rate. Mm-hmm. Philosophical, I just have a problem with that, that there's just too much. There's a too long, a tenuous chain of tenuous inferences to build on all of that. I do agree with the idea that, and this is what I was touching on earlier, you know, supposing you were getting 2% interest in dollars, which you can't anyway. I mean, I guess if you buy treasury bonds, but the average retail consumer in a bank certainly can't. Suppose you're getting 2%, but the Fed is debasing madly away with their printing presses and their policies. Clearly, the value of that 2% that you're getting is less than 2%. And you may actually be losing ground. I just don't think it's as simple as subtract the CPI inflation, but clearly there's something there. So as the interest rate falls, there's a point at which people say, well, screw this. This is no good for me anymore. And then they buy gold. So there is sort of that connection to gold when owning dollars and getting interest on dollars doesn't work for you anymore, then gold is the thing you turn to. Mm-hmm.
So did gold respond to interest rates in, let's say, 2019 to mid-2020? Or, you know, some people say that it in some ways front ran the inflation that we saw or that we're seeing now as well. How do you think about that, Keith?
I think that, so 2019, you know, you're coming off of a long bear market in gold, where it just was out of favor, out of style. And but at the same time, clearly the mainstream, you know, financial world clearly looking overextended at that time. I'm just trying to think pre-COVID, mm-hmm. you know, things just looking less healthy. The interest rate begins to come down. And as that interest rate is falling, you know, if you look at that spread between time preference, which you can't measure, and there is no nice, neat statistic, you can't Google and say, St. Louis Fed, show me the time preference number. It doesn't exist. But, you know, clearly interest begins to fall. I don't know if it was November of 2019, somewhere around, maybe before then. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely falling. The interest rate is definitely falling into February 2020, which is before any kind of lockdown really impacted the U.S. And I think, you know, and then in March, the interest rate on the 10-year hits 0.5%, which is just crazy. But, you know, there it was. So I do think, yes, when that happens, then people turn to gold because, you know, number one, little to no opportunity cost versus owning the bond. Number two, a rise in, you know, increasing distrust that the government's going to make good on that bond. And the whole thing depends on that. I mean, if you thought the government isn't going to make good, then why would you want to hold a lot of their paper?
Mm-hmm. Keith, something you were saying earlier as well, that when we see, let's say, assets start to really go down in a market crash, as you were kind of pointing out, that we could see if the Fed really starts to move interest rates up. Why does gold react in the way of not going down as much as other things and being the first to rebound? Is that risk off bet that gold kind of represents?
Yeah, I think there are several reasons. And obviously, yes, I agree that for every person who's selling gold because they're getting margin calls all over the place, there's somebody buying gold because they're looking at, you know, wreckage and ruin all over the place. I'd say beyond that, all the financial assets, I mean, certainly when you talk stocks, bonds, real estate, they're valued based on the net present value of the future income that they represent. But when there's a crash going on, people will begin to question, is that future income really what you thought it was? There's a great line by Russell Napier, a Scottish economist, who says, the equities he's talking about, you know, stock values ultimately. The equity is the quote, I hope I'm getting this right. I didn't write it down. This has been years since I saw him speak in London. The equity is, quote, the thin line of hope between the liability and the asset. So you get the market action, you know, suddenly crashing, and that hope disappears. And, you know, for companies that have a lot of leverage, which is probably most of them at this point, you know, what is the liability? If the liability matches the asset, or if it's greater than the asset, the equity is worth zero. Mm-hmm. So if you have a share price that's hundreds of dollars a share, and then suddenly it's being revalued in people's minds at zero, boy, could you have a lot of selling. And that doesn't really apply to gold. Gold isn't being valued as a cash flow. You know, it's something else entirely. So I'd say between the violation of their time preference in that crashing, then interest rates are collapsing, at least on the treasury bond. So as interest rates are collapsing, it falls below people's time preference, people turn to gold. Number two, people questioning everything else in the financial universe, but not gold. And in fact, you know, turning to gold as the antidote to everything else they're questioning, you know, for those reasons and probably others, people turning to gold as the safe haven rather than turning away from stocks, bonds, real estate, cars, whiskey, artwork, all the other NFTs, you know, you name it.
What do you mean? NFTs don't have a real world utility, Keith?
No comment.
That's fair.
I'm controversial enough as it is.
So Keith, when we think about, let's say, the different roles that gold and silver have, do they play different roles to you, let's say, in someone's portfolio?
I was going to say historically, they play two different roles. In the portfolio, yes, because silver has this speculative component. That silver can go up or down quite a bit as measured in gold terms, mm-hmm. although the two are definitely tied. So, you know, when you're sitting here as we are now with a gold silver ratio of 80, a lot of people think, well, historically that's closer to 50 or 60 as a ratio. So if gold is 1900, you know, what's 50 as a 38 bucks or something like that. So, you know, there's upside in silver, and that's certainly true. But I thought you were going to ask is historically, why were there two metals? Which is a very interesting question, because the world is full of market dynamics that are winner take all. Mm-hmm. You know, once something emerges as the common standard, everything from the width of a rail car and a traffic lane on the highway to, you know, TCPIP and the internet winning over all the other computing network things, VHS beating Sony Betamax, and for those that are old enough to remember that, the world was just full of these things. Gold was the thing that carried value over distance the best because there's so little bulk. Mm-hmm. But to compare it to crude oil for a minute, the amount of crude oil you'd need to buy that Honda would be a swimming pool full of oil, which also happens to be smelly, toxic, degrades with oxygen or sunlight, volatile, and highly flammable. Just to name a few downsides, where would you like that swimming pool full of oil, sir, now that you've just sold that car? The same amount of value of gold, you could stick it in your pocket and walk down the street. Mm-hmm. That value in silver would be probably, you could fit it in a backpack, but it'd probably be too heavy. So gold just being great for carrying value over distance, you can't really have a local gold price that deviates from anywhere else in the world, because if it was slightly more expensive in Phoenix and slightly cheaper in New York, it's only one plane trip mm-hmm. from anywhere in the world to anywhere else in the world, really. And so it tends to get, you know, evened out. Silver, on the other hand, and one of the reasons for its divergent behavior from you know, price behavior from gold, everyone understands silver has industrial demand. So if industrial demand is falling, then the silver price is going to be weak. Mm-hmm. But the other difference is that silver is the greatest way for especially small savers to carry value over time. So imagine you're a skilled blue collar worker and you want to put 10% of your weekly wage into precious metals. It just isn't that practical with gold. You're talking about really small pieces of gold. There's very high premiums if you want to buy gold in those sizes. Historically, it was worse. It's better now. Manufacturing's a lot better today than 150 years ago. But even so, you know, would you rather have, let's say you're putting $50 a week. So $50 would be, you know, 2 ounces of silver, which has some heft in the hand. It's big. It's, you know, you can touch. $50 worth of gold is like less than a gram. You know, so you'd have to get one of those cards with a little plastic window in it. You can, in the window, you can't touch it, right? But you can see that little flake of gold in there.
You can visit your gold.
That's right. And, you know, so, you know, for the small wage earner, silver is the more effective meaning cost. Mm-hmm. Just simply how much you lose with a bid-ask spread. When you buy, you have to pay the ask price, which is here. When you sell, you get the bid price here. Well, for $50 worth of metal, silver has a tighter bid-ask spread than that little flake of gold. Mm-hmm. And historically, again, more extremely than now. And so the wage earner turns to silver. And so when the economy is turning to crap, the, you know, gold is being bought by the asset-owning class. As long as there are other assets that are liquid that can be sold, gold will be firmly bid. silver being more bought by the wage earning class when they're losing their jobs. Not only they're not buying silver, they may be selling it. Mm-hmm. And so you got a very different dynamic, you know, in various scenarios.
Mm-hmm. So Keith, when we take all of these things into account, you know, the whole point of the report is kind of predicting the price of gold and silver for the year 2022. What are your price targets for this year?
So I said, I think the Fed, if somebody put a gun to my head and said, predict what the Fed's going to do, and they've heard my caveat that I have no idea. I mean, predicting what people are going to do is unpredictable. Mm-hmm. But if I had a gun to my head and I had to say, I think the Fed is not going to hike interest rates very much or hold them for very long, which is what I said in 2015, the last time that we had this sort of episode. And that if the Fed, you know, really aborts that untenable policy position, then I think we're going to see continued rising price, particularly in gold. So $2,200, $2,300, you know, something like that by the end of the year. And I think we could see a very significant silver outperformance, especially if we start to get monetary loosening and, you know, credit freely flowing and all the things that we'll be doing with wages and employment. And people love a boom, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it's capital consumption. They don't realize they're eating the seed corn. But while it lasts, it's a hell of a party. Mm-hmm. It's a feast. So, you know, in that scenario, you could see silver, and obviously the price perking up again right now anyway, you know, you could see silver, you know, gaining percentage-wise much more than gold. You could see $40 silver, something like that. You know, my confidence in, especially in that second one happening a little bit less, you know, kind of depending on if the Fed takes that fork in the road. If the Fed is really hell-bent on hike, what are they, 7 rate hikes, 9 rate hikes, what some people are putting out there, if they're really just going to hike, then you're going to see Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, you know, Countrywide, Merrill Lynch. It's just going to be on and on with bankruptcies and ruin and whatever and selling off. And then that would not be an environment for $40 silver. Let's just say it might be an environment for $2,000 plus gold just because people are escaping the ruin, but it wouldn't be an environment for $40 silver for sure.
Excellent. Well, that kind of wraps up the entire report there, Keith. Of course, it's a great read, and I encourage everybody to go look it up on monetarymetals.com.
Monetary-metals.com.
Of course, we'll put that link in the show notes there. Keith, do you have anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up here?
Stay safe and sane. Don't bet with too much leverage because things could get very volatile from here. And even if your thesis is right, if you're having too much leverage, you can get beat up.
Some sound advice there, Keith. Of course, you're a great resource on Twitter as well, at kweener01. Keith, thanks so much.
My new one is at Real Keith Wiener.
Okay. Different one. We'll make sure we get that corrected.
All right. Thank you.
Perfect. Thanks, Keith. Take care.
Thanks for having me.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.